The title of this conference by Father John Hardin is How to Pray. Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin has been a consultant to the consortium from its beginning and is closely associated with its interests as a communication enterprise for religious women in the United States. Father Hardin.
Last evening and in this morning's meditation, we reflected on why we should, indeed must, pray. We now wish to look more closely at another adverb, how. This how to pray can mean several things. We might ask ourselves how in general to improve our life of prayer. Or we might intend to set about on how to make prayer what it should be, the dominant force in our lives. Or again, how we might better profit from the experience of the great masters of prayer, the mystics, men and women of the ages. This is one thing you learn from experience. Or again, and for all of us, depending on how we are involved in communicating the truths of the faith to others, that having learned how to pray ourselves, we might effectively teach others. There is no more important purpose in Catholic education. In fact, unless our students learn how to pray, we have not given them a Catholic education. In a way, I wish to address myself to all these questions under the single how. But as usual, we try to have some logic and sequence in what we talk about. I want then to speak about two aspects of this how to pray. First, what dispositions ought we to cultivate in order to improve our prayer? And secondly, what practical considerations have been tried and proved useful to grow in the spirit of constant prayer? Dispositions then and practicalia. As we address ourselves then to the dispositions for prayer, we might remind ourselves that it is not a platitude, though it may seem to be, to say that most people's difficulty with prayer arises not so much, certainly, that they have not read enough books, may have memorized whole sections of the chapters from John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, that they don't understand methodology. I believe in dealing, as I have in my life, with so many people who professionally intend to become prayerful, most failures arise from not having cultivated the necessary predispositions. You don't walk into prayer like you walk into a room. You either come properly accoutered, or you just don't get in. All of these deserve serious attention during the retreat. I stopped at 4. The primary disposition is, I think, a mental one. The set condition that we ought to work at, that prayer is efficacious. Born of faith, we must convince ourselves that prayer is not, as the world around us would like to tell us, a psychological monologue. Practically everything we read, and so much of what we see, in a world that is so ostensibly successful, tells us of people who have made their marks in the world, make the headlines, the leaders of nations and of corporations, the tycoons of industry, the leaders of commerce, who don't pray. This, as I'm sure many of you know, to undercut belief in the efficacy of prayer is the first target of Marxist indoctrination, especially in, say, nominally Catholic circles. It is the first premise of modern secularism that man does not need to pray for the best of reasons, because, as the man I consider the American philosopher, John Dewey, so clearly put, it wasn't always clear. I'd say of his 45 published volumes, 40 are practically unintelligible. One little book that is very clear, series of lectures at Yale, called A Common Faith, says, and I've quoted these passages many times, the trouble with Western, still nominally Christian society is this. It still naively believes that man's achievements depend on powers outside of himself, and as a consequence, he does not exploit the energies within him and within the society that man and man alone creates. We breathe this atmosphere. We read these books. We are living in this America. And we better make sure that prayer is not just a word or a bit of piosity, but that in the mysterious designs of providence, if we pray, things will happen. If we don't, they won't. And you don't get that conviction by reading, say, a monthly Catholic magazine. To help become more convinced of the absolute not only need, which we talked about last night, but the divinely guaranteed efficacy of prayer, I suggest rereading and reflecting on those passages of Revelation which insist on the importance of prayer. Prayer. Pray always. St. Paul, whatever you do, do it all in the name of Christ. Christ's monition. Pray that you enter not into temptation. And his guarantee, whatever you ask for in my name, I will give you. And that terrifying negative in John's Gospel, without me you can do nothing. And John's original Greek says nothing. Clearly, on the road to that destiny to which God has called us. I hesitate leaving this subject. It's so important. And I suppose part of the conviction of the efficacy of prayer is the fruit of experience. I hope everyone in this chapel will bear me out, and others I understand that may be listening too, that once you have learned from experience, what happened when you didn't pray, and what blessings come when you did? Oh, then you won't have to listen to a theological discourse on the efficacy of prayer. The mystery is the deepest on earth. In my book, there are two great mysteries. In heaven, the Trinity. On earth, man's freedom. In this case, that man freely, if he wants to, decides to ask God for help. Imagine, have they reached the moon yet? Are they on the moon now? You see how enveloped I am in the retreat. And I suppose I'm asking the wrong people. How little this globe of ours looks. From is it a quarter million miles? And to realize that on that little tennis ball in space, our whole continents, and within continents, countries, and in those countries, cities, and in those cities, people, and singular number, a person, me. And to still believe, what a test of faith, that little, what term shall we use, little dot on the globe, can actually, lips tremble when we use the word, we can't quite use it, we're talking about God, that somehow, when I use my free will and I ask God to help me, the Almighty listens. And that, if I don't ask, he in his infinite wisdom from all eternity, foreseeing that I would not ask, will have decided not to give. The first predisposition, therefore, dealing as I do so much with the unbelieving world, which frankly I think the epicenter of agnosticism in the United States is the University of Chicago, where I have the dubious privilege of teaching. You don't deal with fine intellects schooled in unbelief without convincing yourself, if you want to keep praying, that prayer is not what they, though agnostics, kind of ironical, isn't it? Agnostics do believe some things, they believe that prayer is make-believe. First disposition, then, absolute conviction that prayer is efficacious. Second disposition, deep interior humility of heart. This is more than meets the eye, or for your purpose, meets the ear. Let's look for a moment at what prayer is supposed to be. Whatever else it is, it somehow is to answer to a deep-seated need. Very well. But that's out there. You see, the word prayer can be pronounced two ways. Either prayer or prayer. And it's one thing for me somehow intellectually to, yes, admit that prayer, first pronunciation, answers to an objective need. It's something else for me to be a prayer. Second pronunciation, that I sense the need. The safest statement I can make in this retreat is to say that millionaires are not beggars. Either I have become convinced that I am in desperate need, or you won't have to be told this. We won't pray. Some time ago, in one of my now infrequent visits to Western Michigan University, since my 5 challenging years there, I had dinner with one of my former co-ed students, a bright young thing that decided she won't marry for a long time. Good job, making a lot of money, independent. I knew she wasn't too religious when I taught her, and I figured 3 years, perhaps, had not improved the case. So I asked her, "Rochelle, do you pray?" She put her cigarette down and asked me, "Why should I pray? I've got everything." To me, that statement is a neat summary of the attitude of millions. If I'm going to pray, then, I must become aware of my needs. I must realize, and not merely theorize, about my helplessness, my sinfulness, my weakness, my groping insecurity, my wandering aimlessness, and you supply other terms. This is really, come to think of it, the main reason why God allows us to sin. He must have had a purpose, after all. All kinds of simple divine expedients for keeping us from sinning. Like what? Well, like not bringing us into existence. Simple, no problem. One more seat empty in chapel. Nobody would miss it. We wouldn't even know her name. Or anticipating that we would sin, God might have said, "Well, lights out, press the button." Or he might have kept us from becoming exposed to things which he foresaw would be too much for us. Why then did he allow us to sin? Here we're dealing with a mystery, the mystery of evil. It must have been, and this is what I want to bring out in the second recommended predisposition, that reflecting on our sinfulness and a retreat is good time, because we may have other things to do afterwards. That, looking back and being sure it's the same substantive ego that perpetrated that, and that is me now, deep humility of spirit, which, as we know, is born of humiliation. And our deepest humiliations are not the ones caused us by others. You know why? Because if you're like me, the moment somebody says or does something that humiliates me, my nature comes to self-defense. We think of something good about ourselves to make up for the obvious bad that somebody just revealed. Our deepest humiliations come, but we've got to let them come, and that's what I am saying, from the self-reflection of our own weakness, sinfulness, infidelity towards God. That's why God has allowed us to sin. That was His purpose. And why? Now, there may be exceptions. But most human beings go to their grave with some, and sometimes glaring, faults. God knows what He is doing to help keep us deeply, interiorly humble. Conversely then, and we'll have a chance to talk more about this later, but just to state it now, self-complacency, interior pride, is poison to prayer. It kills prayerfulness like a deadly drug. It isn't only that a proud person will not correspond with God's grace. God won't even bother giving him the graces that he would, because he knows too well, won't be touched. Third predisposition for prayer, absolute honesty with God. We live in a world that, if there is one word that we've all heard many times, and that pretty well symbolizes the modern attitude also towards us, is phoniness. People may not have much of other kinds of principle, but they still respect sincerity, honesty, even to such a trembling degree as to say, well, and you've heard this before, since I don't really believe, whatever really means in that sentence, say in the value of the Mass, I won't be a hypocrite, have you heard this, in going to Mass. We are here speaking of complete honesty with God. No phoniness, no sham. Now, I wouldn't be dwelling so much on these predispositions if they were easy to attain. I know they're not. I'm still working, as I trust we all are. One of the tendencies I don't know when we acquire this, it must be very early. One of our tendencies is to be constantly on display. Someone has said you can really tell what a person is with what he or she does the moment they close the door and they're alone. Now, we don't want to misunderstand this. Part of this, call it display, is really necessary for human society. It has been said quite accurately that the most blessed inhibition we have is that we don't say everything we think. Have any of you seen the play Nothing But the Truth? It's a tragic comedy where for 24 hours the hero of the play, having taken a wager, he would tell nothing but the truth. The incredible jams he gets into, the friendships he loses, the money, all kinds of things that happen to him because a woman is brought to him, that is, introduced, dressed in a bizarre costume, and he's asked, what do you think of her dress? He tells the truth. Now, because we are living in human society so much, we have got to readjust ourselves to living periodically in that divine society, which is the context of prayer. With God, there can be no pretense, not even those amenities and courtesies that make human life livable. I don't say by not telling the truth, but by keeping silence when the truth would hurt. No duplicity with God. No facade. And two words especially. No excuses and no secrets. I know what I am saying, sisters. This is not easy to acquire. It means, therefore, that the moment I do wrong, right away, Lord, I goofed. And in this passage, you can use all of the pejorative terms. Be sure that nobody hears you. I am so-and-so and such-and-such.
This conference is continued on Side B.